Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll begin with an assessment of last night's Democratic presidential debate and analyze the Bernie Sanders phenomenon and his call for a revolution to defeat organized money with organized people. Joining us is Jedediah Purdy, a professor of law at Duke University and the author of A Tolerable Anarchy. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Bernie is Not the New Barry, and That's a Good Thing, which we will discuss. In the article, Jedediah Purdy makes the case that Senator Sanders is running on ideas and policies and not charisma, and that although he could win the presidency, if he loses, his ideas and policies will live on and come back to the political mainstream some years or a decade or so later, as Barry Goldwater's did following his defeat by LBJ in the form of Ronald Reagan's victory running on Goldwater's anti-government platform 16 years later. Then on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, we will speak with the leading African-American scholar and intellectual, Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, who is a senior fellow for faith and opportunity at the Opportunity Agenda, a visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University, and professor emeritus of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He is the author of The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic, and he has an article at Salon.com, The Macroethics of Martin Luther King Jr., and an article at the Huffington Post, Martin Luther King and Immigrants' Rights. And we will discuss both articles and how, although Martin Luther King was attacked by both the right and the left during his short life, he takes his place in history, along with Jesus Christ, as a true revolutionary who, quoting MLK, chose to give my life for those who have been left out. This is the way I'm going. If it means suffering a little bit, I'm going that way. If it means dying for them, I'm going that way. And joining us now is Jedediah Purdy, who's a professor of law at Duke University, where he focuses on constitutional, environmental, and property law. He has been a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, an ethics fellow at Harvard University, and a visiting professor at Yale Law School and Harvard Law School. His writing includes a trilogy of books on American politics and culture, most recently, A Tolerable Anarchy. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Bernie is Not the New Barry, and That's a Good Thing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jedediah Purdy.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be with you.
Good to talk to you, Jedediah. And of course, when you in your article, you're referring to Barry. That's Barack Obama's nickname for those who know him well and play basketball with him, but not like us mere mortals who follow him.
Yeah.
What did you think of the Democratic debate last night? It seemed to me that, you know, I don't know the whether talking about winners and losers makes a lot of sense, but
no.
I would argue that Bernie dominated the debate.
Yeah, no, I thought he did very well, and I thought he did very well by sticking to the core strengths of his campaign, which have all along been ideas, more than personality, more than charisma. When I say in the piece that he's not the next Barack Obama, what I'm referring to is the question that's inevitably arisen: can this insurgent candidate knock Hillary Clinton off the way another one famously did 8 years ago when she was also the presumptive nominee? And so people go looking for the secret to Bernie's charisma because they're comparing him to Obama, who, of course, ran a campaign based on his extraordinary personal gifts and charismatic rhetoric. But with Bernie, it's really been from beginning to end, I think, a very different situation where the campaign is not a function of the person as much as it is a vehicle for ideas that I think people are coming back to about economic fairness, economic democracy, economic security. And I think that's his consistent strength.
And do you think that this is going to build, like on the other side, Donald Trump's strength is, in spite of the terrible things he says? He goes up in the polls. A lot of pundits suggest that Bernie Sanders has been rising, but only amongst white Americans in college towns, and he's yet to prove that he has an appeal with African Americans and Latinos in this country.
So far, I think the numbers are big enough that it probably people probably have to retire that old slur about college towns. He's running the one recent national poll showed with a 2-1 lead over Clinton among voters, Democratic likely primary voters under, I think, 45. So that's a lot of people and not just graduate students. But I think the other question about reaching out to the very important African-American and Latino constituencies is more of an open one. He has a lot to say to politically engaged voters in those populations, I think, about the structure of the labor market, about racialized policing and the racialized structure of mass incarceration. He's really responded to and learned from the pressure that the Black Lives Matter movement put on him over last summer and has incorporated, I think, admirably into the way that he thinks about everything, which is in terms of structure and power. But I do think that's a bridge that looks like it's yet to be built. It's a very important one.
Well, it does seem that the polls, national polls, that say that he could defeat Donald Trump by a greater margin than Hillary, who some polls indicate may not be able to defeat Donald Trump. And, of course, these polls are unreliable and it's very early.
Of course.
But the fact of the matter is that that has to explain something, that difference. And my sense is that one of the appeals that Bernie has in terms of a face-off with Trump is that there's a crossover vote because a lot of the populism on the right meets the populism on the left in terms of dissatisfaction with government and the need for radical change.
That strikes me as right. Economic insecurity and the hollowing out of the industrial job base have hit voters who are really on the cusp in some ways between the two parties. They're the people who were called Reagan Democrats in the 80s, who Clinton won back to a certain extent and who really abandoned Barack Obama in droves. They're people who are getting, to generalize, getting hammered in this economy. And I do think that there are people out there for whom, whether they break Sanders or break Trump, depends. I'd say it depends whether they are looking for radical solutions that are really systemic solutions, which I think is the direction that Sanders is pressing, or whether they're looking for something more emotional and desperate. That's the register that I think Trump's bullying sounds. But yeah, your point is we're talking about some of the same people because we're talking about people who are getting buffeted by the same social forces, and that seems real to me.
Well, the assumption would be that if he became the Democratic Party standard bearer, then the message would get out more and perhaps resonate with these people as a kind of gentler version of what Trump is saying and therefore be more appealing. That's just off the top of my head, if you will.
Well, I would say if I might just tweak it slightly, even more than kinder, gentler, I think there's quite an essential difference that Trump is really, I think, on some level about circling the wagons, about who you keep out, both at the national level, keeping his call to exclude Muslims, and at the level of who his constituency is. It's pretty clear that it's a kind of traditional white America that he's speaking to and conjuring up. And that's not Bernie at all. I think the challenge that Bernie is offering is to think about how we can rebuild a more secure and more equal economy in a much more inclusive world. Because the last time we had a really secure an equal economy in this country in the 50s and early 60s up to the beginning of the 70s, it was equal and secure for some people and a lot of people were left out. And trying to advance the progress we've made in inclusion and diversity while reclaiming some security and equality, I think, is the idea that Bernie's pressing toward. If I might just say one thing, I think this horse race stuff that we're talking about, of course, is fascinating and it's important. But I think one of the really significant things about the Sanders campaign is that because it's a campaign of ideas more than of personality, it can succeed over years, even if he doesn't win this year, and even if he doesn't run again. We could think of him as being a little like another Barry, not Obama, but Barry Goldwater, who lost very badly in 1964, but laid down the basis for Ronald Reagan to win 16 years later on many of the same new right ideas. So a movement campaign can succeed in a really different way from a personality campaign.
And again, I'm speaking with Jedediah Purdy, who's a professor of law at Duke University, where he focuses on constitutional, environmental, and property law. He has been a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, an ethics fellow at Harvard University, and a visiting professor at Yale Law School and Harvard Law School. His writing includes a trilogy of books on American politics and culture, most recently A Tolerable Anarchy, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, Bernie is Not the New Barry, and That's a Good Thing. So, in essence, could I sum up the Bernie Sanders revolution? By the way, and he mentioned revolution a number of times in the debate last night, that the Bernie Sanders revolution is about defeating organized money with organized people.
Exactly.
And do you think it's got a chance? The revolution.
I do.
In the short term or the long term?
I think the part of the fabulous thing about it is that even if it fails in the short term, it could succeed in the long term. I don't think it's out of the question in the short term because it's a surprising year. 8 years ago, Barack Obama's election seemed impossible, and it was extraordinary mobilization and a sense that something was possible that hadn't seemed that way that brought him to winning. And I think we learned a lot. I was involved in a very grassroots kind of way in that campaign. I think all of us who were involved learned something about what movements need to last, which is that they need to be about more than leaders and personalities, that they need to be about ideas that you can keep working for even when your leader disappears or disappoints or doesn't govern in quite the same way that he ran. So I wouldn't rule it out. I think the same kind of surprise that happened with Obama could conceivably happen with Sanders. But I think that even if it doesn't, we can have our eyes on a 20-year horizon here.
But just in terms of your state, North Carolina, Barack Obama won North Carolina in 2008. It was a very key victory and a very unusual one. And the state has changed so much. I know we've spoken when you've been arrested on those Moral Monday demonstrations at the State House. Just a billionaire essentially bought the Republican Party and has turned that state so far to the right. So it's a much more formidable landscape, isn't it?
It's still a very closely divided state at the level of presidential races, and it still splits almost evenly between Democratic voters and Republican voters.
Even though they've basically brought in all of these voter restriction laws to make sure that Democratic voters can't cast their votes.
Right. We haven't seen what the new restrictive laws are going to mean. They're certainly going to make it harder for Democratic voters on the margin, which, as you say, is exactly what they are designed to do. But people have been mobilizing since the laws went into effect to do everything they can to make sure that the number of voters who get excluded by these laws is as small as possible. So our hope is that people will turn out in part because they're angry. You know, sometimes these efforts to exclude voters produce the opposite effect because people come out in big numbers when they recognize that it matters to someone else to try to keep them out. And the state has not changed as much as it looks like it has because it's been gerrymandered all to hell. So a small, small Republican majority statewide has turned into a very big Republican majority in the State House and the congressional delegation. But it could still go blue next fall.
So let me turn to the Hillary supporters and their argument, essentially, and I've heard this from a number of Democratic strategists, that they they say that, you know, there's a tendency in this country for the Liberals to basically commit political suicide by back in 68, instead of supporting a genuine Liberal, Hubert Humphrey, the vice president, they went for Gene McCarthy and Nixon won. And instead of supporting Jimmy Carter in his re-election in the general, they supported Teddy Kennedy, who hurt Carter, and then in the general, this Republican character Anderson split the vote. So there's this idea that you've got this solid, seasoned candidate in Hillary Clinton, and the chimera of Bernie Sanders is going to sweep her opportunity away, and we're going to end up in defeat and have somebody as horrible as Donald Trump, or even as horrible as Ted Cruz.
Both Ted Cruz and Donald Trump are very scary monsters, I agree, to frighten people with. They're very frightening candidates, and Cruz is, I think, precisely because he's less unhinged and more rational, in a sense, and knows exactly what he's doing. He's possibly the more wicked of them. But that's not your question. I think this argument that we should be prudent, trim our sails and limit our expectations, always has some force. It's an appeal to realism, and we do live in reality. But reality also includes real historical surprises, and it includes movements that sometimes change the landscape of possibility. The Obama campaign had to face exactly the same accusations, that it was unrealistic and it was going to give the campaign to the Republicans and put Sarah Palin a heartbeat away from the presidency, it turned out. And that was exactly wrong. So I think that we shouldn't ignore that question, but we also shouldn't be cowed by it. And there are plenty of unpredictable things that can go wrong with any candidate. I think that not pretending to know anything more than anyone else knows, there's plenty of potential for scandal in the convoluted dealings of the Clinton Foundation. There's plenty of potential for trouble in Hillary Clinton's political spouse. And you never know whether you've got a safe candidate.
Sure. Well, Jedediah, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us on this Martin Luther King Day.
Oh, good to talk with you, Ian, and have a good rest of the holiday.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jedediah Purdy, who's a professor of law at Duke University, where he focuses on constitutional, environmental, and property law. He's been a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, an ethics fellow at Harvard University, and a visiting professor at Yale Law School and Harvard Law School. His writing includes a trilogy of books on American politics and culture, and most recently, A Tolerable Anarchy. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Bernie is Not the New Barry, and That's a Good Thing. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about Martin Luther King as a true revolutionary.
Don't let them play us. Girls, they are
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now on this Martin Luther King Day is Aubrey Hendricks, a senior fellow for Faith and Opportunity at the Opportunity Agenda. He's also a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor emeritus of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teaching and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. He has an article at Salon.com and also an article at the Huffington Post, Martin Luther King and Immigrants' Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aubrey Hendricks.
My pleasure. It's always my pleasure, Ian.
Well, thank you, Aubrey. And what's your sense then of how this day is, I mean, obviously, your article at the Huffington Post certainly puts it into a context, particularly in this election year, with this virulence about immigrants and the outrageous statements being made. Just a broader question to begin with, Aubrey. I mean, what's happened to basic civility in this country?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think, though, that, well, basic civility does not serve the interests of those who are in power. You know, they always it always works better when they play on the more base parts of society. They play on people's fears, and it's hard to do that without, you know, raising incivility. Donald Trump is a very good example of that. But then we have the Koch brothers and Alec, what's so frightening is that they're being very successful about it. Who would have thought a generation ago that we'd have this much racism, this much hatred in our political discourse?
But is it possible that there is a kind of, I wouldn't say there's necessarily a movement behind this or a conspiracy, but it does seem to me that racism in many ways is being kept alive in this country by the political right, and perhaps even by the Koch brothers and others who pay for the political right, in as much as the one thing that it prevents, particularly when you consider that most of Donald Trump's supporters are angry white working-class men, is that as long as you have racism, the working people in this country, whether they're black, white, or brown, are not going to notice how much they've got in common and who their common enemy is.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting because Martin Luther King, of course, realized that, and he tried to bridge that gap, and particularly with the Poor People's Campaign, that's what he was trying to do. But as we know, racism serves capitalism very, very well. It keeps workers divided. I mean, all the working class folk should be banding together and not fighting each other, right? But if fighting at all, fighting those who are exploiting them. But they very well keep that division going. And until we make some real breakthroughs in this society, particularly the way we understand political economy and the depredations of capitalism and capitalists, until that time, it's going to continue as it is or get worse. I personally see it getting worse from here because I can't remember this much hatred since the early civil rights movement.
Well, on if there is a bright side, could one suggest then, Aubrey Hendricks, that at least the entrance of Bernie Sanders into the political arena has raised some of these questions about the nature of capitalism, the division, and the growing disparity in wealth in this country, and the extent to which Wall Street and a handful of billionaires control our politics?
No, yeah, absolutely right. It's heartening that he's raising these issues, but my concern is that it's being understood episodically and not structurally. I mean, I think Bernie is not really raising questions about capitalist structures. He's, you know, talking about the effects, the symptoms, so to speak, and not really the causes. And also, though I'm a supporter of Bernie Sanders, his version of democratic socialism is very, very tepid. I mean, it's really just progressive liberalism, and it's not speaking to changing the structures or the relations between workers and capitalists at all in the final analysis, in my opinion.
Well, of course, that was one of the great ironies about the way that Martin Luther King was basically hated and defiled by both the left and the right. After all, you know, we know about J. Edgar Hoover and what he was up to. And by the way, I just listened to the speech the night before he died, where he talked about the concerns that the pilot for the plane that was flying them in to Memphis had about the safety, how all the bags were checked. And he made it really clear that he knew that people were out to kill him. And I suspect he even knew who these people were. But on the other hand, he was also being castigated and ridiculed and by radicals on the political left, including the Black Panther movement. So, I think what's missing in the legacy and the understanding is how much of a revolutionary, in the way that you just said, Bernie's not, or I think Martin Luther King really was a genuine revolutionary.
No, absolutely, absolutely, I am. And I've last few years I've written, I think, three articles on that, on Martin Luther King's anti-capitalism and Martin Luther King, the socialist idea. Martin Luther King never publicly said he was a democratic socialist, but he said it privately, as you know. And he was a critic of, an analytic critic of capitalism from his time in college. And he talked about real changes. He talked about real democratic socialist policies like guaranteed work, guaranteed income. I mean, those kinds of things, which we can do in our capitalist society. But more than that, when he attacked the Vietnam policies, and he was attacking all of the record profits that the largest corporations in America were making from the war, and so he was attacking capitalism at its root. And of course, that's why he had to be murdered. He could not mount the Poor People's Campaign, could not be allowed to do that, because that would bring working people together, and that would also give him, in the final analysis, I think, a platform from which he could have really attacked the Vietnamese War, which means he would have really put his hands into the capitalist pockets. And as we know, that's the greatest formula for destruction in America.
Well, you know, Aubrey Hendricks, I remember reading a memo during the Nixon administration. It was a memo from Howard Hughes, the head of Hughes Aircraft, you know, the billionaire, apropos today's political discourse, the billionaire writing to the President of the United States, Nixon, complaining that Nixon was ending the Vietnam War, and thus Hughes Aircraft would suffer losses because they were making so much money because the Hughes helicopters were being shot down and therefore had to be replaced. And basically this billionaire was telling the President of the United States, you know, you can't end the war because you're going to end this profit stream for us. You know?
Exactly, exactly. And an article I did for Huffington Post called Why Martin Luther King Had to Die, I think 2 years ago, I mentioned some things that are not really widely known. That, like, for instance, in addition to the Council of Military Advisors that Johnson had for the Vietnam War, he also had a Council of Corporate Advisors made up of the heads of the largest corporations in America. And we ask us, wait a minute, these guys, I mean, what are they doing advising the president on how to run a war? Well, I mean, what you just said about Howard Hughes, speaks to that. They wanted to maintain the war and also for it to be run in a way that was most profitable for them. They were willing to use all these young people for fodder so they could continue to make money. Nothing has changed at all in that regard. They're just able to hide it a little better. And King was one of the few, really national figures and international figures who put his life on the line, his reputation on the line, to question that. And we must remember that King was absolutely crushed after he made his anti-Vietnam War speech at the Riverside Church. I mean, 163 papers in the United States almost simultaneously attacked him. The civil rights leaders turned against him. I mean, all of them turned against him. New York Times turned against him. The black newspapers turned against him. He was lambasted, but he continued on because he knew that he had to continue speaking against the war, and so doing, speaking against capitalism, because capitalism is so deleterious to human welfare. In so many instances, most instances, actually, I think, in the final run.
And again, I'm speaking with Aubrey Hendricks, who's a senior fellow for Faith and Opportunity at the Opportunity Agenda and a visiting scholar in religion and African American Studies at Columbia University and professor emeritus of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. And he has an article at Salon.com, The Macroethics of Martin Luther King Jr., and an article at the Huffington Post, Martin Luther King and Emigrants' Rights. Now, let's just turn to immigrants' rights, since it's so much a subtext, in particularly in the Republican presidential debates and their appeal to angry white voters. And not that, we don't even know that they're going to vote, but he certainly there's a lot of people coming out of the woodwork, if you will, supporting him, whether they'll vote or not. And that's one of the calculuses that I think that the progressive pundits get wrong. The assumption is that if Donald Trump runs, it'll be a cakewalk for either Hillary or Bernie. Mm-hmm. But you don't know, do you, in this country, what's going to emerge and how much, you know, angst and hatred and anger and this inchoate sort of populism on the right is going to produce.
No, absolutely. It's, you know, that the hatred and the racism has always been beneath the surface, and well, I guess similar to Ronald Reagan, Trump is telling folk that it's okay to come out of the woodwork now, and it's okay, and for us to take over again. Let us reassert our hegemony, which is what, you know, Reagan did. He made it okay to be racist again. The way Trump makes it okay to be racist again, as he says, he likens racism to political correctness. And so no one wants to be, has to be politically correct. That means you can be as vile as you want to. And I think really Trump is bringing just into the open what's been there for so long, and we've seen it raise its head in certain ways, but there's no one been, no major candidate who's been as vile as Trump, and so the haters didn't have the kind of room that they have now, before now, to speak their minds. And also, you know, he's validating the worst in people. You know, you have folks who feel a certain way, but they don't hear it in the public discourse, so they might question themselves whether they're really, you know, whether that what they're thinking is really right or not, or you know, they might feel isolated in their thoughts. But what Trump tells them is, no, you're not isolated. No, you're part of a movement, of a majority, and we're taking it back. And remember when Barack Obama became president, and before he could get in office, good, we heard across the country, we want our country back. I want my nation back. Well, what they want it back from, they want to take it back from the boogeyman, you know, the progressives and particularly black folks. And then that sentiment sort of, it changed. It continued to be out there. But now it's coming front and center again. And I think they're going to come out in large numbers for Trump. They see a path to victory and a path to subjugating those who were previously subjugated politically again.
Well, that certainly explains the venom that has been thrown at Barack Obama for the longest time. So what would you say then to the constituency that elected Barack Obama twice Are they asleep at the switch? I mean, do they not recognize the danger in what you've just said and what could be coming our way?
I don't. Why do you think they're asleep at the switch?
Well, I guess it's a question of numbers. How many people show up? That's what that's what elections are about. And if Trump is going to surprise everybody by bringing an awful lot of voters out that haven't voted before, what's happening to counter that? I mean, that's why when I talk about it being asleep at the switch, I mean, you know, you've just given us a wake-up call.
Well, you know, you have to remember that Trump's preeminence is in the Republican Party. And he's not, none of the polls show him winning the presidency against the two major Democratic candidates. I think that, and of course I'm hoping that, but I it seems to me that his support might be a little exaggerated. But I think what he has, I think he's mobilized people, you know, progressives, much more than seems to be talked about, to come out and counter that kind of violence, because it's really frightening, you know, thinking people and people of goodwill, and horrifying them. I mean, they're, women are being horrified, and religionists are being horrified. And in the final analysis, the evangelical right is not going to vote for this guy, because he's, you know, he's vile. But then again, he was at Liberty University today. But also, we must remember Jerry Falwell was vile too. So I guess that stands to reason.
Well, again, it goes back to what our original point that we were talking about is, which is what's happening to the country, to its polity, to its the public discourse, the extent to which this vile rhetoric is being accepted. And once you break the mold of decency and restraint, then all hell is broken loose, and this is our moment. So, you know, it really is a question, I guess, of, I would say it's time for the religious left to rise up.
Absolutely right, absolutely right. And, you know, we're trying to do that. You know, the articles I mentioned about King on Huffington Post have been recirculated this day quite a bit. And I encourage all of your listeners to go on Huffington Post and look up those articles on Huffington Post or on the internet, and Aubrey Hendrickson articles on Martin Luther King, because I talk to some of these, I speak to some of these issues. But in terms of this, the vile, the ugly, and hopefully not, but possibly, you know, homicidal nature of some of this this rhetoric, it's been there all of the time, like we said, but it's been diffused. Now it's being focused by a man who has no principles at all but to serve his own interests, who's an immature child, who's ignorant of the political process, and he's bringing it all together, and it's a watershed moment, I think, in America. It could get much worse from here. I mean, much worse. We could see blood spills from here, I think. It wouldn't be the first time. So you're right. The left has to get out and make sure that we counter it. But, you know, Ian, let me just say this. There is a way that the left is not showing up, and that is not, they're not countering this vile rhetoric enough. They're not denouncing it strongly enough. And I think that's because the loudest moral or religious voices, unfortunately, reside on the right.
Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation on this Martin Luther King Day with Aubrey Hendricks.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming. But I know a change gonna come.
telling lies. It's that, that you're not on your own. Watching faith in prayers will make you see.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation on this Martin Luther King holiday with Aubrey Hendricks, who's a senior fellow for faith and opportunity at the Opportunity Agenda, a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University, and professor emeritus of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teaching and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. And he has an article at Salon.com, The Macro Ethics of Martin Luther King Jr., and at the Huffington Post, Martin Luther King and Immigrants' Rights. Let's just touch on your Huffington Post article for a moment, Aubrey, because particularly when you point out the cynical nature of the anti-immigrant movement in this country, and particularly these well-funded anti-immigrant think tanks that basically try to create a black and brown divide and essentially try to co-opt Martin Luther King as though he were against immigrants. And some of the powerful stuff that you have in this article, most of it, actually the most powerful stuff in it comes from the Old Testament itself. In Deuteronomy, God makes sure that orphans and widows are treated fairly. God loves the foreigners who live with our people and gives them food and clothing. So then show love for those foreigners because you were once foreigners in Egypt. And then from Leviticus, the alien who resides with you shall be to you as the citizen among you. You shall love the alien as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. So there, you know, I tell you, I always get completely, whenever you think about the Bible, you wonder, how did the religious right claim and co-opt the Bible when they've got it so wrong? At every turn, they've got it so wrong. And in the New Testament in particular, is so much about love. I mean, it's not about, you know, Jesus Christ didn't have an assault rifle. He didn't hate homosexuals. He didn't celebrate capital punishment. He didn't shake down poor people for money on television. I mean, what?
You know, I would call it ideological Christianity. Christianity distorted and twisted to fit the people's interests. Ku Klux Klan is a good example. I mean, they twisted things to fit their interests of hating and wanting to destroy black people. But that is a real problem with what's going on in Christianity these days in America, and that is that the religious right, they ignore, number one, they ignore everything that does not serve their agenda. Justice, the word justice occurs more in the Old Testament than any other word, actually more than any other term or concept in the Bible other than God. You never hear them talk about that. Jesus talked about poor people and their needs more than anything else other than God. They don't say anything about that. Do you ever hear them talk about love on the right wing? Never at all. And see that, and that's the problem. The problem is that they, like when I was growing up, one of the worst things you could be told, at least in the black church, is that you don't know Jesus. Well, they don't know Jesus. They know what they want and what their interests are, and that's all we hear. And the left has a lot of blame to bear because the left does not take religion seriously enough. And whether you believe in religion or not, in order to reach people, we have to understand what it is that they're thinking and what they believe. And you know, on the left, man, it's almost like it's not cool to be a believer, and that has to change. You don't have to be a believer, but we have to understand what these people are thinking so we can counter it, and because many of them don't know any better. They're sincere, but they're sincerely wrong. And they can be shown another way, hopefully by someone who's not black, they might change their ways.
Right. Well, you know, it's pretty easy to point out the historical record is pretty clear on when the religious left gets its act together, how powerful it is. The religious left ended slavery, brought about civil rights, human rights. Against child labor. All of the great step forward in human civilization were brought about by the religious left and people of conscience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's true. We need to see a resurgence of that again. And it's very serious. I'll tell you, when you look at progressive think tanks, there are very few that take religion seriously or that try to speak to the right, the Christian right wing's frame of reference and frame of understanding. And that's very, very telling. We are not going to beat these people into submission, the people on the right wing, because they're in the thrall of the hegemonists who are pushing all the wrong values and all the wrong information. And we're not going to beat them into submission. We have to be able to talk to them and understand them and also show that we respect what they believe. And the only way we can show respect is to have some idea what it is, and then have an idea of why the way they do it is incorrect. And we're not seeing enough of that at all. That's what I'm trying to do, and what we're trying to do with the Opportunity Agenda, the social justice think tank that I am affiliated with. We're trying to speak to those issues and to use, like, George Lakoff and his work about framing, to try to bridge that gap between our understanding on the left and their understanding on the right, and to have us all get on the same page in terms of justice and mercy and love.
And as we discussed earlier, Aubrey, the Bible is on your side. One of the problems with our contemporary American societies, of course, is there no longer any consensus about what is true. You know, you have all these spin doctors spinning it. You know, he who spins the truth the best wins the argument nowadays. Mm-hmm. So that's a real problem when you have all the data and text and science on your side, and still people don't believe. It's a tough road, but at least I think we can take heart in the fact that the Bible is basically a left wing document. It's not a right wing document. But let me ask you though. But we talked about Donald Trump earlier, and you talked about his immaturity because he's so egotistical. It's embarrassing to watch, and it's all about him. And it's just shocking that he has nothing to say, but he's going up and up in the polls. And I think, you know, one of the fascism emerges in a political context when there's a failure of democracy. And I don't think you can disassociate the Trump phenomenon from the general disgust that most Americans have towards politics and towards the polarization and broken nature of our government. Mm. And inevitably, when democracy fails the people, they turn to a more illiberal model. In this case, it's not fascism so much as right-wing populism, but it's a real threat, I think.
It's a real threat. And, you know, when you have someone with the maturity of a child who is narcissistic to the point of megalomania, and who will do anything to win, anything to get praise, and he realizes that he can do that by demonizing people, then we have a really, really dangerous brew. I mean, he's shaping up to be as bad as Father Coughlin was back in the 30s, the 40s, and any demagogue that we have seen in America. He actually might he's a more powerful demagogue than George Wallace was. And he is just, his rhetoric is just as unprincipled. And if it served him to start screaming on black people, like Wallace did, he would start doing that. And so it's a very, very dangerous moment. We ask ourselves, how did he become the spokesperson? How did he become so important in this whole mix? Well, it's only, again, because he is ignorant enough to say the things, the kinds of things that the least politically and socially enlightened people in America are thinking, and he makes them feel like they're important and they're right. And that's a dangerous, dangerous phenomenon. And people are going to get hurt. Remember that in one of his rallies, they were putting someone out, and people were saying, it was a black guy, they were saying, burn him, burn him, burn him, lynch him. Mm. And he doesn't say anything about that? I mean, this is terrible stuff we're looking at here.
Sure. Well, you know, I don't want to depress you further, Rupert, but I don't think that the guy who's running second on the Republican side, who now the Republican establishment is beginning to basically grudgingly accept as mm-hmm. the alternative to Trump, even though they hate Ted Cruz, they're mm-hmm. starting to warm up to the notion that he's our best chance. Ted Cruz is not much better. He's I think in many ways he's more cynical than Donald Trump, because he's appealing to the same people that Donald Trump does, in that sort of populist way where he says he's against the establishment and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. When his wife works for Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. they took out $1 million mm-hmm. loan for him to get elected mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs and Citibank, mm-hmm. which they didn't disclose. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's very clever, much cleverer than Trump is, although Trump's instinctually very, very clever. Mm-hmm. This guy is so cynical and so smart. I tell you, either way, it's not there's no comfort there, whether it's Trump or Cruz. They're almost as bad as each other.
I think you're right. Cruz is worse in some ways. And he's also shown himself to be an unprincipled, very unprincipled person. But because he has a deeper reach into evangelical Christian voters, that makes him more dangerous in a certain way than Trump, I think. And because he knows how to use religious and religious discourse to serve himself. And he's willing to lie and stand on it. Trump's outrageousness that he stands on, well, you could see that it's outrageous, but not with Cruz, right? He's clever enough to make it sound like his position is correct. When he talks about carpet bombing, and all the military folks say, you don't go in and carpet bomb a city where there are all kinds of women, men, women, and children. He has said repeatedly, I make no apology for wanting to keep America safe. Now, and he's getting away with it. No one's calling him a madman.
Right.
Well, no one's being called a madman in the Republican Party these days, which I guess is even more scary.
Well, it is, and it's very hard, just to wrap up here, because I've really enjoyed this conversation. Not that we've been talking about anything that's particularly heartening here. that I don't understand, and I know what this guy's appealing to, and all of them on the Republican side, the way they demonize Obama, and even when he succeeds, he gets the 10 sailors back, he gets the prisoners out of Iran, and they just spit on him every time and deride him. But what they're appealing to is a very strange paradox, and that is, they're basically trying to tell us, the Republicans, that the most powerful nation in the history of man, the most powerful nation on this planet that spends about, God knows how much more than any other country, about 10 or even 20 of our closest rivals combined on defense, yet we're somehow under threat from a few of these characters driving around in pickup trucks in the deserts of Iraq and Syria. We're spending 60% more on defense today than we spent during the Cold War, when we had a real enemy that could wipe us off the face of the earth. What's going on here? Do you have a handle on that?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with racism. A black president could not possibly be seen as being, not possibly being able to be as able and as competent as he should be, or as a white president would be. And so it's easy to question everything that he does. If not, when he got bin Laden, the people would start thinking and say, well, wait a minute, he's not soft on these people. I mean, you have people on the left who are very upset because Obama's been running so many bombing missions. if they didn't have these blinders, these racist blinders on, it would be they might be able to give them some objective consideration. But and so I think the biggest problem there is, I have no question, is that is racial hatred, racial resentment of Obama. And I'll tell you, I'll give you an example, it's not talked about much, but while he was running for president the first time, there was a 60 Minutes interview of his daughters, who were very smart, and who were very smart then and very articulate. They were, much younger. And they were so clear-headed that the racists came out and said they were coached. Those couldn't have possibly been their words. How dare they coach those children and brainwash them like that? The racism wouldn't allow them to accept the intelligence. And Obama, they can't accept anything good about Obama. He's one of the most brilliant men we've had in office, and he's trying to do right. They can't see it, and they can't accept it. He's taking away our guns. There are more guns now than ever.
Sure.
And the laws are more loose than ever.
Right.
Oh my God.
Well, look, we have to wrap up now. It's been a wonderful opportunity to talk to you on this Martin Luther King Day, Aubrey Hendricks. I'm very, very appreciative, and I'm sure our audience is too.
I appreciate talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Aubrey Hendricks, as a senior fellow for Faith and Opportunity at the Opportunity Agenda. He's a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor emeritus of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teaching and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. And he has an article at Salon.com, The Macroethics of Martin Luther King Jr., and he has an article at The Huffington Post, Martin Luther King and Emigrants' Rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.